one of our most active persons in a membership campaign at that particular time, or during those early years, was a young man at Elk Ridge by the name of Charles Fletcher. He'd get out and cover that whole Elk Ridge area and bring in large numbers of people that didn't make meetings, but they always supported. And as Eugene Holland in Cooksville area, also a very active person, never took in a leadership role, but they were strong pillars of support. Raymond Johnson from Ellicott City was a young man there who took all kinds of roles trying to improve housing condition in and around Fells Lane at that time. The Fells Lane housing slum was one of the big projects that prevailed and carried through until that housing was finally established. There off Fells Lane, Ellicott City, in that slum area was eventually wiped out by the county, and the situation greatly improved. So those are just a few of the people. The Roger Carter, who supported, never carried any major office, but they gave that financial support and other kind of support he could give when there was a call. Clarence Call went out for anything. These are people that responded and ready to go. The elderly minister who passed, Reverend Charles Taylor. You could just name them by the numbers, then you get off into individual groups, persons that really gave support from one end of the county to the other. You could always call upon that cadre. They wanted a representative number, and Mr. Julius R. Warren ran the barbershop out there. He and his wife were staunch supporters. The Thomas King in the county at that time, later left, went to Baltimore. He and his wife were very strong supporters, and always there, never too busy to respond to call when an urgent call went out for representation on given problems related to school, to housing, to any other situation arising in our county. And they generally brought with them varying degrees of competency. They could tell you about certain things pertaining to probable solutions to a problem. That was a strong point of fellowship. The NACP at that particular time was more like a church organization in its approach to community problems or countywide problems. We operate on a countywide basis. Anywhere there was a problem, then everybody had a problem.
What was the relation with the black churches in Howard County and the civil rights movement?
Very good. We always were into those churches at least once a year, sometimes more. So they made contributions financially as well as individual enrollment. And certainly played a pretty important part in disseminating information. We use them as various kinds of depots to disseminate information through the community. And in some instances, together. Most of the black ministers were responsive. There were one or two who never did respond during my active work with the organization. Never could get any response. But you could still go into the churches. You're always welcome when you went. They just didn't respond to written instruments. And that was not too unusual. Still isn't too unusual today. People sometimes today won't answer written instrument.
What was the general outlook during the 1950s and 1960s of the Howard County government towards the whole human rights issue, the whole movement?
At first it was very reluctant, then went and reserved. And then a progressive board was elected, and progress began to show itself. It was generally done quietly, but done. We didn't care about the noise, we just wanted the result. So persons like Mr. Charlie Miller, who is still a council member over there, began to take a very progressive point of view towards our requests and demand, give support, and then others elected to the board did likewise. So established pretty good rapport with those men. Our leadership did anyway, and generally you got a commitment from them. The commitment was paramount to execution of the task or enactment of the desired measure. Said they would commit themselves to removing signs from the courthouse that went down. That was before all these things were abolished by law. So that was a turning point and a change in attitudes coming all along, even before we had the passage of the Civil Rights Laws in 1965. So we had begun to, it made tremendous strides prior to that in Howard County.
What changes have you seen since the early 50s? And as you mentioned before, the work of the NAACP, the program is slightly different because of the times. I think maybe this go along with this more subtle maybe. What changes have you seen from the 50s to the 70s? What's the emphasis now, do you think?
Well, a more emphasis on the politics our times. More emphasis being directed towards the economic needs of our time. The bread and butter issues are really paramount now. People want jobs, want housing, those things are there. The NAACP is certainly having to address itself more to these critical concerns rather than to the large philosophical issues of the past. One time, our whole thrust was in the area, in the arena of education. Improve the educational program, improve people's minds, attitudes, and hearts. Well, now it's towards the total economy now. Jobs, housing, what have you, all moving down that line now. And the NAACP no longer can be a one-shot or one-target organization. We have to cover many facets of concern today. We got to increase our lobbying techniques at all levels of government where laws are enacted, laws are enforced. The Criminal Justice Division has become a very important concern, consumes a considerable amount of time our legal staff in intervening in cases or giving advice where they're not actually involved in it per se. At the same time, we still have to stay with school cases because school cases are still coming back after years and years of litigation, not been resolved. So we can't get out of that arena and say we can throw all our attention now to political enactment of laws with guaranteed income, so forth, or we can get over and get the job of breaking barriers, all levels of employment, breaking up the former Little White Courthouse gang and so forth. We no longer can do that. We got to deal with elected officials at all levels now, whether they be white or black. You still got to deal with them. So it's no longer just dealing with a white electorate anymore. It's dealing with many others who have come in this whole process of change. So the NAACP has had to broaden its front to many facets. It takes more money, takes more personnel, and the time dimension goes on. So you got to have a scholarly foray into the field now. It's no longer just the old noise and rhetoric. You got to know your subject matter well. You got to be able to present it and sell it. And so it's a case now. Many people coming to the marketplace. So you're no longer just competing just for basic rights. You're competing now for the right to live and live in this society more abundant. And that is a difference in what it was even 10 years ago. And in the schools now, you're no longer fighting to get them in the school. You're fighting now to integrate them fully in the school activities. And that's a difference in integration and desegregation to me. I've always seen a difference, and never will, by the fact that they're synonymous.
Do you think there's been backsliding on the part of society or on the part of government and its commitment to securing human rights for all citizens?
Oh, definitely. This whole administration, starting with Nixon, has been a retrenchment of forces, a withdrawal of our economic attainments, educational attainments, you name it. That has been an increasing pace, not a decreasing thing. As President Ford said to the NAACP in its meeting last year, he says, during this period of inflation, we can anticipate and expect a depreciation rate. Well, we don't. Not as a citizen of this country, my rights are not tied in with the inflation of the economic means of the dollar. I would never buy that again. Tie myself to whether the dollar fluctuates or down, whether the flow of jobs increases or decreases. And of course, nobody buys that. That's a valid argument. Who is thoughtful and who is concerned about his personal welfare? And that's a difference I've seen, a constant erosion of previously gained avenues for addressing one's self to the ills of our society. And it all borders very much. Racism has no longer become the hidden agenda. It has become the open form of a pattern of behavior again. It's not flagrant. It's not name-calling and beating over the heads with billets and turning loose fire hoses and so on people, but it has become the practical, smooth, slick political maneuver. Preconceived by consent of parties, we manipulate. We put one black hole here and keep 10,000 out. So that has been, we pick the kind of black that is easily manipulated and is not going to rock the boat, not speak in behalf of others. We'll keep him pacified, the heck with the rest. And that is what we see in these types of measly appointments that are frequently made when they reach out and pick a black that represents nobody, doesn't even represent himself, strong. And say that he's a representative. We've done something about the minority member. Or the attempt to take the white woman there and call her a minority. We didn't have any women, so we put them there. Now you got a minority member serving. Well, or to take anyone else, or take the black woman for an instance, because she easily manipulated sometimes and doesn't rock the boat. So it's much easier to appoint a black woman than it is to pick a man who might be vocal and representative of his group. So we take the way of least resistance, which is insincerity at its best. We get someone who doesn't know his subject matter and put him in a situation where he become, from the first day, the picture of scorn and ridicule. When you don't know your subject matter, don't know you aren't likely to be such an apt learner that you can start off knowing what you haven't been exposed to. Nobody can. We don't give him sufficient time to get duly job oriented and show some competency. If you pick a person whose level of competency isn't there to start with, he isn't likely to ever get there. And that's what I have seen, apartment after apartment, this county and around this state. We'll pass over the competent to pick the least competent person. And that, to me, is not by accident, by intent.
How do you account for the decline and membership in the NAACP and some of the other old line civil rights groups like the Urban League? And
well, as people have become more affluent, certain groups of black, they have excused themselves from the movement, saying, I no longer depend on it. It's no longer a major concern to me. I'm doing all right. That is typical of any group, black, white, oriental, whatever you have, is that personal status improved. They have a tendency to drop out of any movement or mobilization or any pressure group. They want to get away from it. My lot improved. You got black flight out here just like you get white flight. Each time they improve a lot, a little bit, they leave Washington and move out here. Get a better home, assume better environment for my child and what have you. And that's just a natural pattern of human behavior for an aggressive person. So it's no different than black. You have the same kind of diversity in blacks as you have any other group. And it isn't going to be any different. Looking for the same economic improvements, looking for the same social satisfactions that you have anywhere else. So it's not that common bond that you would want to attribute to. Some blacks don't have any loyalty to other blacks. They don't even see themselves as being a part of the situation. They've never known some of the real plights that some others have known. I hear plenty of them in mind, getting around and say, well, I've never known discrimination. Well, you have to ask yourself, where has this person been? They certainly haven't been in America. They haven't lived in a major portion of this world, because discrimination worldwide is not just here in the United States. And to hear someone make that statement, you just wonder if they can really identify the realities of life. Or if they belong to some other society that just descended. So maybe they do. I never bothered to even dignify that comment with reputation. Just look at it, shrug and shoulder and smile. I think I'm talking to a blind. I learned years ago, none is so blind as he that refuses to see. You can have all your visual acuity if you don't care to use it. You're just a blind person. So, I don't have any public or private resentment for that person. Feel that they may wake up someday and it may be a lost cause. So that's one thing I have noticed as I travel around the country. I find it everywhere you go. And as other groups have grown up, there are people who aspire for roles of leadership. The NAACP has been pretty much a one-person image. One person, the executive director, by and large, from the history of the NAACP, has been the main spokesman and has had the closest attachment. When the president sits down with the executive director, he doesn't sit down in reality with the NAACP or its board. And that's the way it has been. And that aspect of it has changed. Executive director for years has called the shots in the NAACP. Now, a new element has come to the picture. The board is beginning to become far more assertive, and rightfully so. So the image of the NAACP as an old-line civil rights organization is certainly making changes. It's not so radical at this point in time, but progressive change. CORE and other organizations played a very important part in the mid-60s and late-50s and just about moved off the scene. Some of that could be attributed to the personality of the so-called leadership. Some of it could be to the personal taste of McKissick and others who went off as private ventures. They want to live, they want money too and other things. they couldn't afford to give all that time voluntarily to an organization that produced very little for, in the way of personal attainment or goals or dollars and cents. So they have to live, they have to be realistic. It has given these other splinter groups that develop here and there, and each time they are attached as letterhead organization to an individual. Generally, they have followed a one-issue platform. As soon as that issue has been resolved or abated to some extent, they have faded gradually out of the picture. For a while, they got the news media behind them, and the news media has sensationalized in regard to them, but no issue stays in the headlines forever. Watergate has come in flashes. And a few years from now, you talk to somebody about Watergate, they don't know what you're talking about unless they're students of history. So that's just the way it is in our social life in America. We go from one climaxing activity to another. But in spite of all of this, since 1909, the NAACP has stayed in the arena, and I predict it'll be here until the day arrives when we truly see rights and privileges abound for all Americans. Then I predict that eventually someday it's going to fade out. But not during the 70s. I see this whole decade of the 70s as being a period of retrenchment. We'd like to go back, like to turn the clock back. And very vivid attempt. We see the action of Supreme Court, which is becoming more and more conservative each day, reversing prior broad-faced decisions. If they're not reversing them, they are seriously amending them to such an extent that the real effect of them is paramount to none. That was the intent of the Nixon administration to bring on that kind of conservatism. All evidence is now have five there who are very much alike in that respect. So it's getting more and more 5-4 decision. And of course, in the Congress, we see many people who say they're reflecting the feelings of our constituencies, but I contend they're reflecting the feelings of the vocal minority. But I feel that majority is still silent when it comes to any of these issues. Or as they say, I wouldn't go out and advocate against. I'm not going out and advocate for you. That's what you run into in many, many situations. Then we have a president who constantly keep harking on the negative, looking for political return. That's definitely descriptive of the incumbent. He would turn anything about it if he could vocally. Well, I don't think his real feelings might be that way. But anything on the basis of political expediency is a policy with. Or civil rights to sell a whole shoe bank if he thinks it's going to earn him the vote that will guarantee his re-election.
Do you think there's going to be a change, though, in this fall? A change away from the Nixon-Ford retrenchment into something different?
Well, I'm not a student of politics. I don't know anything much of what the Democrats will do or the Republicans. I'll say this. I think there's going to be a continuous shift slightly in the other direction. I think it can be turned around. I don't think the president alone can do it. But I think a forceful Congress is going to bring about a reversion in the general trend now. I don't think we can afford to let all the goodness of the 60s be eroded. the poverty program under Johnson was a noble idea. It wasn't the program that was bad, but the administration of the program, we have to say. What they should have done was worked on administration, not kill the program, as the intent has been to kill the program. While we go right on poorly administrating everything else. And that is the thing that you have to see, and that is so obvious as you go from city to city. The city is just becoming dead areas, boarded up, buildings run down, it's here, there. So they really need a tremendous amount of money to revive city area. And you never convince me that our cities can just die like that. Because too many people are there. People that couldn't make it on a farm, do other things. They have gone to the city. They are there now. We must do something to keep them preoccupied and worthwhile. I mean, we can't go out and carry them all on welfare. Welfare will never be adequate. Wasn't designed as a program that way. The programmatic structure makes it something else. The best jobs and all have not really gone to raise the level of the poor. They've gone to the people of means to start with. Still the decision makers and peanuts, so to speak, gets down to the poor. City after city, town after town. Now we got it invading your suburban area.
Do you find it true in Montgomery County or in Howard County now?
Oh, yeah. We have our large areas. Got some rather larger spots here in this county that are truly deprived. They're not seen when you travel basically in the area.
Are these predominantly black areas? Or?
Oh, they're black and white. Maybe more poor whites than you got. Blacks, but they're here. They take you right in this community. It's hidden, well off the road. Everybody goes there, just about all white. But it's still a deprived and depressed area. And then we move from here on up from this county and back towards Burtonville, which has remained relatively static. We have pockets, scattered sites. They're not a large concentration until you get to Sandy Spring on Brook Road, then you run into a large black area. And then you move on around there and back towards Brighton Dam and all, and you got white scattered sites, sunshine. So they're there. And they're not seen. The other faces are not seen. In Howard County, you go along New Cut Road, there you got a small pocket. You come right on out of Ellicott City on Main Street, you got a small pocket right there. No real improvement, housing, sanitary conditions, and nothing else. They've been there and they're still there. Circumstances not getting better. Every day it's getting worse. Yep, they're right there. Those who administer sit right down the hill. All of it right on the nose. Like Fells Lane used to be, there was this tension. But those things in Lower Ellicott City, right down there in that area, around the old railroad and all, they're still there. So we haven't done much to improve in sight all the beautiful houses and modern convenience. There are still large numbers who are not enjoying those things yet. And those are problems we must grapple with. You leave there and you go down and get into the Waterloo community, Upper Guilford community, built all around behind it with Industrial Park. No sewer down in here. These people can't improve their lots of houses. They fall into what we call an undeveloped area. Because they can't meet standards when the facilities are not there for them. They don't put the sewer line down there and they're handcuffed. They know that. It's not by accident, it's by intent, I contend. But when you withhold the services, you're certainly going to inhibit people who populate the area. put sewer line all down in for the business places. Got them down on the lower end coming down. Nothing in between, so people are caught. The land certainly will not stand septic tanks and other things anymore. I would say they're oversaturated now. So just caution, no health epidemic is broken out today. So that's one of the problems you run into. Would you care for some coffee or something?
No, thank you.
Wouldn't you care? Have you eaten breakfast?
Yes, I have. Thank you, Mr. Kraft.
Yeah, you're welcome.